Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday morning, it's April 21st. Currently 50 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Under partly cloudy skies, we've got 53 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. We're going to be looking at a mixture of clouds and sunshine. We'll call it broken clouds throughout the day. We'll be seeing those temperatures surging well above average again for us today, with highs climbing near 70 degrees in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the mid-70s in the Heber Valley. Now, we've got a strong upper-level low-pressure system moving our way, heading into the middle of the work week, so your Wednesday will bring significant changes. In fact, as you're looking over towards the Park City area for your Wednesday, look for a chance of rain and snow showers, believe it or not, in the forecast, with those highs only in the 40s as we go throughout the day in Park City. In the Heber Valley, we'll see those high temperatures in the mid-50s. We'll see that chance of rain showers, maybe even a rumble of thunder developing throughout the day. As we move into your Wednesday night, any scattered shower activity that we have around will likely turn into snow showers across the Wasatch Back, as we'll be looking at those temperatures dipping below freezing both in Park City and in the Heber Valley. So watch out for that. As we go into your Thursday, we'll keep some scattered showers in the forecast, primarily a mixture of rain and snow showers for us over towards Park City, with rain and snow showers turning to more rain showers in the afternoon in the Heber Valley as those temperatures climb back into the 50s for highs. It stays somewhat unsettled heading into your Friday and the weekend. We'll have a couple of more disturbances rotating through the area. Temperatures pretty much hover in the upper 40s to low 50s in Park City each afternoon. We'll see those highs hovering in the mid-50s to upper 50s for us over towards the Heber Valley. Either way, we'll call it partly cloudy skies, and each day we'll at least have a chance of a few isolated to scattered showers, primarily in the form of some rain showers out there for us. Now, as we go into the weekend, we'll keep that chance of moisture in place, but as we get towards Sunday into Monday, that's when our next main storm system moves in. That'll bring us a better chance, I think, of seeing some rain and snow showers, both in Park City and in the Heber Valley. That's primarily going to be Sunday night into Monday as well. That's the latest look at your forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour, we'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybow. Later on, the admissions deputy counsel for the Utah State Bar Association, Emily Lee, with details on an alternative pathway for law school graduates to have to avoid taking the bar. And finally, from Recycle Utah, we've got Executive Director Andy Heck, along with Education Director Chelsea Hafer, with the latest from the Recycling Center and the celebration of Earth Day. Well, the largest steam locomotive in the world rumbled through Summit County yesterday to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. KPCW's Connor Thomas was there.
Hundreds from around the state and the world stopped their cars and lined the Union Pacific Railroad tracks from Morgan to Echo Monday to glimpse a steel fossil roll back to life. At 133 feet long and weighing 1.2 million pounds, the Big Boy 4014 is the world's largest operational steam engine. It arrived in Echo Junction shortly before 11 a.m. and drew a crowd of both the nerdy and the curious, like Summit Park resident Wendy Westerfeld.
I'm not like a huge train fanatic, but I find anything historical and unique very interesting. So I want to have that be a part of my life. I don't want to let it go by without seeing it. To me, it's important and it's fun.
Union Pacific says it commissioned 25 Big Boys starting in the 1940s, but only 8 survive today. Big Boy 4014 returned to service, burning oil instead of coal, for the Transcontinental Railroad's 150th anniversary 7 years ago. The Big Boys were designed to move World War II equipment and other large loads between Ogden, Utah and Cheyenne, Wyoming. That's where 4014 was headed Monday.
It was a day where we all came together to think about history and to appreciate all the rail workers that gave their lives to giving us a way to come together. The Chinese rail workers, the Irish rail workers, so much of our society and our character is within the railroad.
Kimball Junction resident Angela Hill, like Westerfeld, was following the Big Boy along its route. Hill was headed to Evanston, Wyoming to see it after it chugged through Echo. Westerfeld had just seen it in Morgan. pausing for a half hour in the historic Morgan Station before a crowd of veterans, families, and school children. 4014 didn't so much whistle as it roared. While the country celebrates its 250th birthday, Morgan Station is celebrating its 100th. Station historian Tyler Clark says the railroad helped the city recover from a plague of grasshoppers in the late 1860s.
A lot of the businesses that used to be in the center of town moved up to here and kind of built up Commercial Street. And so ever since then, the railroad has kind of really transformed Morgan from a farming town to a railroad town.
Back outside, a Frenchman in a cowboy hat named Thierry Levine was celebrating American independence and preaching the benefits of train travel.
I'm part of a committee that tried to promote putting back a travel train for Americans in the U.S. Yeah, Europe has a wonderful, huge network, a high-speed train from Lisbon straight to Krakow and Poland.
Levine also says he was there to honor the French-American military alliance that helped win the Revolutionary War and later World War II. He handed out small American flags for spectators to wave as Big Boy 4014 rolled out for Wyoming. It was scheduled to reach Cheyenne Friday and will begin the eastern leg of its cross-country journey in May. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the Wasatch County Council meets tomorrow at 4 o'clock. On the phone with a preview of the meeting is County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So a new council member will be appointed. How many applicants did you get for Carl McMillan's vacancy?
So the process for county is actually a little different from a city. The Republican Party has a responsibility of picking the applicant. So I don't actually know how many they got, but they went through a selection process and recommended Michael Murphy to us. Our council is really just accepting that recommendation.
Oh, okay. So the council wouldn't even interview him or anything. He just jumps on board, huh?
No, the state code process really doesn't give our council that purview.
Okay. Can you tell us anything about Michael Murphy? What do you know about him?
Yeah, he is an associate member of our planning commission. We actually just upgraded him earlier this year to a full member of our planning commission. And I know that he is running to fill that seat permanently. So this appointment will only go through the end of this year. And he's a candidate to be for the next 4 years of that same seat.
Okay. And then he'll create a vacancy on the Planning Commission if he's elected?
Correct.
All right. This is for seat F. What area is that in Wasatch County?
So this area covers basically the eastern portion of the county. So it's anything kind of north and east of Highway 40 down even into the border with Duchesne over there. And it also goes up into the north part of the county as well. So it extends much of the eastern portion of the county.
All right. Sounds like the council will also be appointing a new chair. Did Council Member McMillan serve as council chair?
He was the chair, yeah. And so I think we're going to officially identify a chair and then a vice chair just so that we can keep doing business.
Okay. Let's see. The council will also get a presentation on the parks concept. What's this about?
So Wasatch County received a grant kind of in the second half of last year, and we've been working with a consultant to work on three park projects. The first one is our Veterans Memorial Park. This is located just kind of on the west side of Heber City, next to Southfield Park. And we're looking at ways to improve merrily the parking and kind of amenities around the existing baseball fields. There is a concept right now that would include realigning the road that goes adjacent between that and the Heber Valley Railroad. It's 600 West. And making it a little more narrow, a little more pedestrian friendly, and so that we can fit maybe better parking and make it a little bit safer for people crossing that road. The other two parks are actually new parks. Wasatch County just received a 12-acre parcel. This is kind of out in the East Heber Valley area, roughly 2400 South and 2400 East. And so we'll be talking about, you know, what that park could potentially look like, including some all abilities, features, pickleball, tennis, things like that. And then along that same road, but at the north end of it, just south of Lake Creek Road on 2400 East is a 10-acre parcel that we actually got a couple years ago, but because we had this grant, we have the chance to kind of plan it there. And I think that one will have two concepts, maybe a phase one and a phase two of kind of just a passive park. It's kind of a weird park on a, it'll be on a hillside with a canal and also has a flood channel through it. So there are some physical constraints on that piece.
Yeah, so how much was the grant for?
The grant was for just, I believe, just under $200,000. And it's been really great working with a qualified firm who is doing this and some other projects for us as well.
Yeah. Who did the grant come from?
I believe this is an outdoor recreation grant. So this is a state level grant that we were able to do some regional planning on. We have a grant writer through the Heber Valley Tourism and Economic Development who's just been really, really good at helping us leverage our funds and do a lot of really great projects.
Okay. And the donation of the 12-acre park came from whom or where?
It was actually part of a development process. So there is also a school site on this piece. So this is the Ranches at Farm Meadows. It's a few dozen homes, but there's a large open space in the center that is being dedicated to the park, and there's a piece on the south that is directly off of 2400 South that is a potential future site.
Yeah. Well, and as you know, I mean, building a park is one thing. Maintaining it in the future is certainly another. So where does that funding come from?
Yeah, and that's part of aligning with what the Parks and Recreation Department is working on now is our long-term master plan of making sure that we are adequately preparing for those things. The overall, I think we intend to use a lot of our transient room tax funds that are, we're expecting a lot of upward mobility in that as some of these hotels come online. So we're trying to set ourselves up for plans for how to use those funds in a way that meets the highest and best need of our community so that when we do have those funds available, we know how to put them to that best use and make sure that we're being responsible with them.
All right, so what are we talking about? I mean, you said we're gonna work on some master plans. We don't have those plans yet.
Yeah, so we have a master plan that is kind of a capital replacement facilities maintenance plan. We are in the process of beginning some public outreach on what I would consider maybe a more broad reaching a plan through Parks and Recreation. So there is a community survey. We're actually going to do an open house on these parks. That'll be on May 19th. That's a Tuesday night. And so we're hoping public input, because this is just the initial concepts. We really would like to hear from the community. That's kind of what these things will cost, but we want to incorporate that into, well, now how do we slot this into, here's all the other things we also want to do. How do we prioritize these things as we go forward?
Yeah, so I mean, do you anticipate more than just playgrounds? Or are we talking, you know, softball fields, things like that?
Yeah, so those other types of things. So these parks that we're talking about now, like I said, the Veterans Park is primarily just parking and playgrounds, pavilions, bathrooms, that type of thing. The new Ranches at Farm Meadows Park will be all abilities, pickleball, tennis, playground kind of facilities. But the long term, if we want to continue to offer the same level of service for, say, like our Little League sports programs, we're already reaching a level that we are kind of limited at some point on the capacity of the number of participants that we can have. So if we want to continue to have, you know, kids in baseball and in soccer, we will need additional facilities, and we're working on concepts for those things. So then the question becomes, well, what is the priority? Is it some of these all ability things, or are we going to prioritize some sports? And those are the things that the council and we want community input on as well.
Okay, so that open house May 19th, time and location?
5 to 7 at the recreation center's classroom. So this is just on that east side of the recreation center.
All right, let's see. Councilmember Luke Searle will be asking council to consider a scholarship. What are we talking about for high school senior?
Yeah, so this is actually a scholarship for CAPS students to attend, I believe it's a competition. So there are 5 students that are requesting $1,000 each. Wasatch County has a tradition of funding some of these types of competitions. We've had, 4-H and other groups come and compete. The soil team comes almost every year. Wasatch County has a very competitive agricultural evaluation program. So I think this is a kind of a request to about some students as they work on kind of more business things. That's what the CAPS kind of caters towards.
All right, so out of a multi-million dollar budget, $5,000 isn't that much. I mean, just in contingency or something? Where does it go?
Yeah, so the council has a line item in their budget that is a council discretionary fund. We use it specifically for these types of requests where the council feels like this is a community priority, and we've identified that item in our budget. And we generally have about $10,000 a year that gets used on things like this.
Yeah, and I guess I'm just curious why it would come to the county instead of, say, the Education Foundation or the school district itself.
You know, I think we end up becoming just one piece of the puzzle of how they fund these things, and that the county isn't the sole funder, but we do support these programs.
All right, let's see. The council will also decide who sits on the MIDA board. Is this in an ex officio capacity, or do council members actually get to vote?
Yeah, so actually every member of the MIDA board is an elected official that is appointed through a number of ways. So the Speaker of the House gets to make an appointment to the MIDA board. The President of the Senate gets an appointment to the MIDA board. And then the governor appoints the remainder, which are elected officials from areas in which there are projects. So Wasatch County, by our interlocal agreement, has a full seat on the board. We've had a number of council members, and Carl McMillan most recently filled this seat on the MIDA board. We decided that, I think it was early last year, was when that recommendation was made. So what we would be deciding is making a recommendation to the governor of which of the county council members we are recommending to go onto the MIDA board. And typically the governor takes our recommendation pretty quickly.
Yeah, and you know, as you mentioned, yeah, all of these folks on the board are elected officials, but I mean, who does MIDA answer to?
I mean, it is that governing board that sets their priorities. So it's a mix of, I think it's mostly mayors from the Davis County area of their project area. Wasatch County, there is a couple representatives from the House of Representatives and the Senate as well. So,
yeah. And again, I mean, even though somebody may not agree with what MIDA's doing, you know, they may not reelect the person that sits on MIDA in Wasatch County, but that does nothing. I guess, again, there really is no accountability to who a MIDA, you know, answers to.
I think the best source is if people do have concerns, you know, you can talk to your state legislators, because the way that MIDA operates is dictated by state code. Its creation, its operation, what its purview is, and what authorities it has, those are all set by state code. And so the state legislature ultimately ends up being that kind of check on, hey, this is what we think you should be doing, this is what we think you shouldn't be doing. And so people, I think there is a recourse to our legislators.
Yeah, but it's still, I mean, it's taxation without representation.
MIDA doesn't actually impose taxes. They are collecting taxes, they're using them, and this is by agreement with whichever entity. So in Wasatch County, they have agreed to participate with Wasatch County and our entities. Again, those are all set by state code.
Yeah. Again, they collect taxes. They suck taxes out of Wasatch County, really. Yeah. And then, I mean, again, no say in how those dollars are spent or what projects they are spent on by Wasatch County residents, huh?
Yeah, well, I think it's also important to note that MIDA actually has a requirement that any taxes they collect in a given area have to be used in that area. So while there are changes to how taxes get allocated, all those funds are going to entities, businesses, investments in Wasatch County. And that's one of the reasons why I think we feel like there are tax changes because of our relationship with MIDA. But overall, we think it will have a positive impact on at least the county's budget, our economy, and there's a lot that we stand to gain from our relationship. There is a little bit of give and take there, but.
All right, the TAP tax recommendations are out. This is, again, the Trails, Arts, and Parks tax. How much does the council have to work with here?
So I believe the TAP board was recommending a little over $200,000 this year in awards across a number of different projects, mostly arts projects, but we have a few parks and trails projects as well.
Yeah. Any idea how many applicants that were, you know, that asked for money?
You know, I think we got something like 25 different applicants, and we got requests for over 400,000 in funding. There were a few projects that either didn't meet our criteria or we felt like would have fit better at a future application, and not all of them that we didn't fund them fully, so.
Okay. How many of those 25 will be funded then?
I think it's about 16 is what we're making recommendations for. Most of these are relatively small grants. The biggest one is a parks grant. That's for $75,000.
Okay. And that would be in the packet later on so people can see where that money's going.
Yes,
to.
I think that packet will go out later today.
Okay. Finally, a Northfield celebration. What are we celebrating?
Yeah, so I think Wasatch County has been talking with our Open Lands Board about the desire to try and do more, both to communicate about the good things that we've been able to accomplish with our open space bonds, and also to raise awareness and potentially even interest in additional people participating in securing open space conservation easements, primarily in the North Fields, I think is where there's been a lot of priority. I think this has been an increased emphasis since the UDOT released the draft EIS, and the urgency that at least some people feel around ensuring that we're doing what we can to protect the agricultural features of the North Fields.
All right, and finally, just any comments with that study that came out recently from the Kempsey Gardener showing that growth in Wasatch County is actually slowing down? Certainly one of the fastest growing counties, though, in the country.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's something that we kind of have expected as our property values have just gone so high so quickly. We kind of expected it to slow down. By slow down, we mean from, you know, four times the state's rate to just only two times the normal growth rate across the state. So we're still talking about continued growth, just maybe at a more modest pace. And honestly, it sounds like a great opportunity for us to continue to get our feet under us, make sure that we're handling all of our services responsibly and not being so reactive against as much explosive growth.
Yeah, and what kind of impact does that have then on the update of the general plan?
So this is actually integral to it in that we are doing our general plan right now and incorporating this type of data into it. I don't think overall it will have a huge impact because I think who we want our county to be is kind of independent of when we get to be that thing. So it's a factor. I don't think it really drives a lot of our decision-making process, though.
Okay, anything else you want to mention?
No, not today.
All right, Dustin, thank you.
Thank you.
Dustin Graybow serves as Wasatch County Manager. Well, a program developed by the University of Utah Law School and approved by the Utah State Bar allows law school graduates the opportunity to go straight to work without ever having to take the bar examination. On the phone with details about the program, I have the admissions deputy counsel for the Utah State Bar Association, Emily Lee. Good morning, Emily. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you. So tell us, what is the alternate pathway to licensure program?
Sure. I'm going to kind of start from the beginning. So this program, back in 2020, when the COVID pandemic hit, the Utah Supreme Court gave a one-time emergency order to allow graduates of law schools who met certain qualifications to be admitted to the practice of law without taking the bar exam because of restrictions on, right, like distancing and things that were going on during that time. Once that occurred, and we realized like the ceiling did not fall in on attorney licensure, a number of individuals from both law schools actually and members of the bar and the Supreme Court came together to create a task force to look into whether or not Utah could offer a non-bar exam pathway to admission for those who have just graduated law school. And over the course of 3 or 4 years, they did extensive studies, talked to other individuals across the country who were very much involved in attorney licensure, and in 2024 presented this report to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court approved moving forward with that. So over the course of 2025 and ultimately in October of 2025, the Supreme Court approved the alternate pathway to licensure. So what this does is it requires an individual who is in law school to complete a certain courses that cover a wide range of topics and exposes them to legal research and legal writing and clinical experience. Once they graduate from law school with those courses, they then engage a qualified supervising attorney is the title used in the rules. And that is a Utah licensed attorney who will oversee 240 hours of supervised practice by these candidates for admission. And then these candidates, once they've finished the supervised practice, will take a performance assessment. It's a written exam that gives them kind of a closed universe, some cases and statutes and a fact pattern, a case file to then produce a written product so we can objectively assess their performance. And once they have completed all of these requirements, then they are eligible for admission, just like someone who has taken the bar exam, just like someone who has been practicing in another state for a number of years can come in. So that is kind of the program, and it's how it's evolved over time.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the bar exam has long been considered the standard for measuring legal competency. So I guess why move away from that model? I mean, if someone's going to spend 240 hours of supervision, why not spend that time studying for the bar?
Sure. And it's a valid question, and it is one that we have faced over the course of this entire progression of this program. The bar exam has evolved. It is no longer what it looked like in 1950. It's not even what it looked like in the 1990s or the early 2000s. In fact, for Utah, Utah did not adopt its current bar exam until 2013. And this current bar exam, called the Universal Bar Exam, is developed by the National Conference of Bar Examiners, a standardized exam that is given to the majority of jurisdictions across the country. There is value in that. There is value in having an objective, psychometrically based, standardized test that we can rely on. However, as we have progressed and as we have talked with the NCBE and realized that even they are changing the bar exam, right? Starting in July 2026, they will be giving a new version of what they have been giving. It's called the Next Gen exam. And it fundamentally changes how they're testing and what they are testing. And because of that, there have begun conversations among jurisdictions, Supreme Courts, admissions administrators, to determine what actually is competence, what are we testing, and what is the best way to test that competence. And in so doing, we have realized that the bar exam holds value, but we can also offer an equal but distinct way of assessing competence that does not include the bar exam. And in that way, we can reach a wider number of individuals, not to lower the bar. And that's the common pushback, is we're lowering the bar. We're not lowering the bar. What we're doing is allowing those individuals who can't take off work to study for the bar exam, or those who have small children who want to also have the opportunity to be admitted to practice. And so we're simply widening the reach of assessment of competence. And it doesn't take anything away from the standard bar exam. We still give that. We will still give that for years to come, and it's a great way of assessing competence. This also is a way for us to assess that same type of competence, just in a different method.
Yeah. So is there any evidence or research that suggests that the bar exam may not be the best indicator of whether someone will be a good attorney?
Absolutely. And it's part of the research that was done by this task force that came up with this alternate pathway proposal. There was a report done in 2020 called Building a Better Bar. And it went through, it presented 12 building blocks of competence and how it can be tested. And from that report, others have also been generated, right? It is a discussion across the country of whether or not the bar exam is the best indicator of competence. And the building the better bar, those 12 building blocks, is what our alternate pathway program is built on. We can connect every requirement that we have and every course that we are requiring to one of those building blocks. So we have a great foundation for our program. But there is research that, that calls into question the standardized exam. And I think it's important to recognize that any standardized exam is going to have deficiencies, right? It is unreasonable to expect that that is going to hit perfection every time for every person that it tests. So we weigh that against its benefits. And for administrators who administer a high volume or who process a high volume of applications and examinees and who are going through hundreds of people who want to be admitted, standardized test does offer a great basis on which to determine that. And so it's a back and forth, but there is quite a bit of research done on whether or not it is the best way.
So as you mentioned, participants will be supervised or mentored. And I guess who has time to do that? Because now you're taking away from somebody's billing hours.
Sure. And it's not necessarily taking away from their billing hours. These qualified supervising attorneys are, for the most part, already attorneys within a firm where these candidates will be working. And so they are already directly supervising these individuals. The intent is not to take away their work. The intent is to place the candidate in a situation with someone who has been practicing for a number of years, who understands what is required of a new attorney, and who can gauge whether or not this candidate is showing the appropriate amount of competence. And it's reasonable to believe that these situations, these relationships would happen anyway with new attorneys. What happens, though, is these firms and these employers can bring on candidates earlier than having to wait for them to be admitted after the bar exam, or have them wait until they finish studying for the bar exam, because they're doing work while they're doing these supervised hours. So while it does look like we're taking away and we're asking them to take away from their own billing hours, and we're hoping it fits into a natural kind of relationship that would organically happen anyway.
Mm-hmm. So the participants would have to go through the training before they're actually certified then?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, they're not licensed until afterwards. So they have to do the 240 hours. They have to take and pass the written assessment that I was explaining before, and finish all the other requirements of admission. And then they will be eligible to take the oath of attorney and be licensed.
Mm-hmm. And some clients may feel uneasy about hiring an attorney who hasn't passed a bar exam. I guess what would you say to reassure them?
Mm-hmm. First, I acknowledge that, right? This is a new thing. And the thought of hiring somebody who has not been admitted in the same way as they've always been admitted is unsettling. It is. The first thing I want to mention, though, is we had a number of individuals be admitted without taking the bar exam back in 2020. And there's no evidence to suggest that they have somehow hurt those they are serving, right? That there is any kind of difference between the legal services they are providing and the legal services of someone taking the bar exam. You can't tell the difference there. And the second thing I want to mention is we're looking at competence, and someone who is proving competence on the job and has gone through those requirements, or someone who is proving competence because they've been able to prepare for the bar exam and show that competence on a standardized exam, if you really dig down into what competence is and what we're trying to assess, there is no difference between what we're trying to assess. And so to those individuals who are unsettled, I say take a chance on them. First, you're not going to know who's licensed by bar exam and who's licensed by alternate pathway. The public will not be seeing that when they pull up an attorney's profile on the bar or on the bar's website. And the only way for them to know is if they were to ask and to look into that. So take a chance on them.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that was my next question. I mean, what transparency is there for clients knowing how their attorney was licensed? That you're saying there is none unless you ask.
Correct. And that isn't anything new with this. We're not trying to hide the ball. We do not put on any public-facing website how attorneys were admitted to practice in Utah. And that goes right for those who have practiced in another jurisdiction and then came here after those years of practice, for those who took the bar exam. That's not anything that we put on our website. That's something that those attorneys can disclose if they want to do that.
All right. So what about those who may need to work out of state? Would they be allowed to?
So the requirement is the qualified supervising attorney has to be an active Utah attorney, first and foremost. And they have to have been licensed in Utah for at least 2 years and practiced anywhere for at least 5 years. So someone who is working out of state, I guess it's a more nuanced question perhaps, and maybe I can ask you to clarify what exactly you're asking, because with remote work, someone could be located out of the state and still be practicing Utah law and still be supervised.
Okay.
Someone who is living out of state practicing another state's law, that's not what this program is intended to facilitate.
Okay, yeah, I guess that's what the thing is. If somebody, they would have to take, if they wanted to practice in California, they'd have to take the California bar.
Absolutely, yes.
All right, and then are there other states that are doing something similar?
There are. There are other states that are doing it. Oregon has a program, and South Dakota has a program. Other states are developing programs. Nevada has recently kind of, I don't want to say overhauled, that might be too hyperbolic, but they've gone through a lot of changes with how they are doing their assessments, and they have a supervised practice component. And so it is kind of a growing trend. As of right now, someone who is admitted in Utah via alternate pathway cannot transfer that license to another jurisdiction. There's no reciprocity at the moment between the states who have similar programs. We're hoping that changes. But it is a growing trend, and it's always being talked about as the years pass.
Hmm. And I guess the need to do this was just not, we don't have enough attorneys?
Not necessarily. It's not, I mean, that's always, right, like, do we have enough attorneys to fulfill the need? I think there were a number of reasons that this came about. One, like I said, this generated from what we call diploma privilege back in 2020, but it was a one-time order by the Supreme Court, and when they saw that worked and it didn't implode, right, the licensing programs or the licensure of attorneys, I think ideas started generating that perhaps this is a great way to reach more people, to give more people the opportunity to be licensed. There is always a component of can we get more people so that we can serve more people, right? And I use the term access to justice lightly. It's kind of a buzzword. But giving more attorneys to Utah to fulfill the legal need around the state is always in the back of our minds as regulators and as those who are within the attorney licensing realm. But I think more so it was, this worked, and we want to see how far we can make it work.
Okay. Emily Lee, I'm out of time, but I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on. You have a good day.
Emily Lee is the admissions deputy counsel for the Utah State Bar Association. It's the 56th anniversary of Earth Day tomorrow. Recycle Utah is celebrating. In the studio with an update from Recycle Utah, I have Executive Director Andy Heck, along with Education Director Chelsea Hafer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Good morning, Park City.
So neither of you were around for first Earth Day, but it's something you wanted to talk a little bit about, just for the and the history of Earth Day here in Park City. I certainly remember the days we used to celebrate and then always got rained out, so.
Yeah, Recycle Utah's been celebrating Earth Day actually since we were an organization. The first celebration that I was able to find in the park record archives was a hazmat day that was held by the group that eventually became Recycle Utah in 1990, and we became an organization in 1991, and after that we were a big part of the Earth Day celebrations in Park City. There was a 5K Globetrot going through the park. People would roller skate, people would bike around. So Andy and I weren't here for any of that, but yeah, there's been a lot of different iterations of different parties and celebrations and events held by Recycle Utah throughout the years.
Yeah, we used to do a town cleanup and then had to move that, I say that, back to May just because it was snow. Nobody wanted to pick up trash in the snow, let's put it that way. Yeah, so, I mean, it's kind of evolved. You had parties at Squatters up at the Wasatch Brew Pub. Now you're, going to celebrate tomorrow at Twisted Fern?
Yeah, we'll have a good old hootenanny over at Twisted Fern. Big thanks to Adam Ross, who's the owner of Twisted Fern, and a wonderful board member of Recycle Utah. It is a fundraiser. We've been doing this for many years, and we are looking forward to this one very much so, because we have some pretty big announcements about the land and new facility and all sorts of really cool things going on right now.
Okay, so you're not going to spill the beans here, huh?
Well, technically I can't, because we're waiting for some information to come out tomorrow from City Council, but I can tell you that the public benefit analysis was published last week, and that is the benefit of transferring, conveying the land that Park City now owns, the 4.18 acres out on US 40 by the High Valley Transit bus barn. The conveyance to us has gone through this public benefit analysis posting to show that that by giving Recycle Utah this land provides a huge, huge public benefit to all of us.
Sure. What is the latest with the move-out date?
Well, we are waiting for some information to come out tomorrow, so I don't want to say anything for sure, but it seems like we might have a little bit of an extension, and that allows us to look at phasing our construction, so we'll have a temporary facility on that land go up before we are kicked out of our current space, so we will have 100% continuity of service. That is our design, so we won't have to close for more than just a couple days to move some equipment.
Okay, and it sounds like you've kind of like made some changes at the center itself to kind of allow some access to where the city needs to.
Yeah, it goes with that project of undergrounding those power lines, so that's a big, huge project between Park City, UDOT, Rocky Mountain Power, and we were told that the whole back wall, the fence line, has to move in 7.5 feet. So as soon as we found out that was happening, we jumped on it. We're like, okay, let's just get ready, because when these guys are ready to start the construction, we can't be a delay for them. So yeah, we restructured like where our plastics tent is, and just some minor shifting around.
Okay, have you sold out for tomorrow's event?
We still have a few tickets left. Go online. If you are interested in coming to Twisted Fern tomorrow night, go online right now, get your tickets, because we will open them up to guests for a forum that's in town, a conference called Race to Zero Waste that starts today. And any leftover tickets are going to be offered up at a price to the guests that are there. So,
okay, so tell me a little bit more about that Race to Zero Waste.
I'll turn that over to Chelsea.
Yeah, we're really excited. Park City's incredibly lucky that this conference is coming here. It's an international organization, and it's just waste professionals coming from all over the world, different organizations, just to share their experiences and their knowledge. And I think there's a lot of exciting things happening with waste in Park City right now, and so it's really timely, and we're really lucky to be involved and get the word out. And so, yeah, that starts today for us. If anyone's interested, today would be the easiest starting point for people. It's 5:30 to 8 at the Jim Santee Auditorium. They have some workshops, some zero waste workshops, and dinner's included, and you can get your ticket. It's only $20. So if you aren't looking to spend two full days going to the whole forum, then I would start with tonight. It's going to be pretty cool.
All right. And then are Recycle Utah staff going to be part of this, or?
Yeah, we've been involved along with several other organizations in the town, helping promote it. I will be a speaker tomorrow. I'm very excited to share a few things about philanthropy's role in changing waste systems. We have some great organizations in town, and get to speak a little bit about the transformative power of philanthropy. So yeah, we've been involved. We'll also be doing, Chelsea's leading a few tours at the center. I know we have a pretty booked tour coming up here in just a few minutes.
I get to teach 80 babies at Soaring Wings today, so oh, I'm excited. Yeah.
Okay, so the tickets, people wanted to come to dinner tonight at the Jim Santee and for the presentation, online at recycleutah.org?
Yeah, so that's at zerowasteforum.org, and then it's also linked on Recycle Utah's website.
Okay, let's see. Let's talk a little bit about some upcoming events. Chelsea, you want to tell us what you got going on?
So we have our Hazmat Day. That is our spring Hazmat Day for Summit County residents. That is this Saturday. And you can get a full list of what we're accepting at recycleutah.org/events. But we are only accepting residential waste. It's a pretty expensive event for us to put on. So if you come, bring some paint, bring some solvents, chemicals, anything under the sink that you aren't using, please consider dropping a few bucks, because these events cost us $30,000 a year to put on?
Boy, we just printed that sign. I don't remember. It is not free. We do get some money from the city and county to host these events, but it does cost Recycle Utah quite a bit of money to host these events.
Yeah, I think Water Reclamation Department as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, and that's going to happen again this Saturday, 9 to 1, in the Silver King.
Yeah, so it's not at the Cabriolet lot anymore because of the parking garage, but it'll be right by the first time lift base. Then we have Dumpster Days coming up also at the end of April. So that's going to be April 30th through May 2nd, Thursday through Saturday, and those are 9 to 4 p.m. Again, residential waste only. We're going to have a yard waste bin, and we're going to have a dumpster bin. So if you want to skip a trip to the landfill, you can come bring your trash to the Boneyard Woodbine Way parking lot right by Recycle Utah.
And again, I was going to say, do you have a list online, though, that people, can you bring mattresses?
Yeah, no mattresses, but we do accept things like couches. So it's the list is online, and it's no hazardous waste. It's just general residential waste, and those bins will get hauled just to the landfill. So, and then we also have green drinks coming up. We have another green drinks next month that we are really excited about. We are partnering with Summit Land Conservancy and Swanner, and it's at Swanner. It should be a beautiful evening. It's a lovely time of year to be at Swanner. And that will be focused primarily on the connection between land preservation and water conservation, specific to the Wasatch Back. So that's a good one. That's going to be free this time around. Rebecca's Kitchen is going to be catering, so we're really excited about that.
Again, the date and time.
And that's on May 12th from 6 to 8.
Okay. And then in addition to other tours, you're going to be doing your landfill and Three Kings Water Treatment Plant tours.
Yeah, so we have three Kings Water Treatment Plant tours, and all of those are free. You can register online. We have one in May, one in June, and one in July, and for the exact dates, you can go to our website. And then we have a landfill tour next month on May 13th. So if you're interested in touring some of the facilities that process our water or waste, you can go to our website. All of those are free tours. recycleutah.org/events.
Yeah, are you doing any events, though, or tours, though, for folks who work? Because they've traditionally been in the morning.
Yeah, it's hard because the staff of these facilities, it's when they're around, too. So I don't want to make them stay. This is the times that they're available.
So usually the morning hours?
Some of the Three Kings tours are at 2 p.m., so they're a little bit later. But the landfill tour is at 10.
Okay. Leslie, it sounds like an opportunity for a live broadcast from the landfill.
I've mucked around there for a while. Okay, guys, anything else?
Yeah, you know, just a big shout out to a few of the programs at Recycle Utah. Number one is come by, take a look at our store. We have a reused store there that's used by a few, and it's heavily used by a few. And I'm not sure if the rest of the community knows about that, but we take all sorts of items that are still in working order, and we'll sell them. So come on by, take a look at what we've got. And then a huge shout out to a program that Recycle Utah has that is seldom talked about, at the cleanup days. We have a volunteer group that comes by, a volunteer who manages groups that come by. Last year, we had over 500 hours, over 48 days of cleanup along the corridors in and out of the town. It's an amazing collaboration between Basin Rec, Park City, Summit County, and UDOT. So we do quite a bit in the community, and be on the lookout for those programs.
Okay. Andy Heck, Chelsea Haver, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.